The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast. It's Thursday, the 9th of August, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Haydn Locke, CEO of Emerson, that's EML. And Haydn discusses the grant of additional research permits at the Chemisset Potash Project. Also on the podcast, Graham Lunderson, CEO of Motif Bio, MTFB. And Graham explains the notice of allowance for the two US Iclaprim patents with an expiration date of 2037. Also on the podcast, Russell Lamming, CEO of Keras Resources, answers private investor submitted questions. And Aidan Bishop, chairman of Big Dish. Dish is a ticker there, gives an update on its UK growth strategy following the company's recent admission and acquisition of Pouncer.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Haydn Locke, CEO of Emerson. That's EML ticker. Haydn, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back, Justin.
Okay, you've had an RNS out of late, a significant grant of additional research permits, and we'll get into the detail of this, what it means, significance of it, in a bit. Before we do, Haydn, you haven't been listed long, so maybe some people are not aware of the company. Could you describe or summarise what you're all about, please?
Yeah, Emerson is a development stage potash asset in northern Morocco, and we raised money, as you said, at the start of June this year, well funded, and we're really pushing ahead to assess the technical and economic viability of what we think is a very exciting potash asset in Morocco.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, take us through some of what you know about the asset here, the resource, and where you are in its development.
We've already got a large inferred resource in place of a bit over 300 million tonnes, which we think is enough for this project to have a mine life of at least 20 years as it currently stands. So it is already a very large project. There is a lot of development technical work that needs to be done really in the next 6 to 12 months to understand the technical viability of the project. We've already kicked off the scoping study, so all of those work streams are really pushing ahead well. We've guided the market that we're going to have that completed by Q1 of next year, and we're still very confident we'll be able to meet that timeline fairly comfortably. So it's an exciting time for us.
Yeah. And like I say, you've got a decent sized resource there, but you've granted now you've got additional research permits. So why are you looking for sort of more resource? Are you, or what?
That's exactly right. You know, the basin that this project is located in is absolutely huge, and we've done a fair bit of desktop geological work to kind of understand what the extents of the basin are and where it gets too deep to potentially host a resource that's amenable to underground conventional mining. Mm-hmm. As a result of that work, we decided to peg specifically 15 additional permits, but the ones we're really focusing on are those 11 permits up in the northeast area of the project area, where we see a very logical extension. There's some evidence already from historical drilling that the potash horizon continues all the way up there, in fact many kilometers past those permits, so we've got a fairly good idea of what's up there. It's not necessarily going to be an early part of our mine life because the resource gets a little bit deeper up there, but it adds certainly to the multi-decade, multi-generational view that we have of this project, that it could be very much larger than what we've already got.
Yeah, and so what are you going to be doing there? The next, you know, what's the work program going to consist of there, and when's it going to be taken, you know, undergoing?
The first thing that will really benefit these additional permits is we're going to put out an exploration target. We've got our geologists working on all of the historical technical information that's available for those areas to really start to formulate, you know, how much bigger could this resource be. The area of land that we have pegged up there is sort of about the same size again as our project, so that gives a rough indication of where it might go. It's a very big area, and not all going to be mineralised, because they certainly include some of the margins of the basin, but we're very hopeful that it'll be a potentially large exploration target up there.
Yeah, and for someone listening right now who's not familiar with the sort of potash and the market, so why is this, why do you think, you know, Emerson is economically viable, and you know, in regards to the largest sort of potash or macro market or where you are at the moment?
So we have a fairly strong view that the Chemisette Potash project has the potential to be low capital cost development. Mm-hmm. And that there are a variety of reasons why it has the potential to be low capex, but we expect it to be significantly lower than the peer average on a per tonne of product produced basis. That means that you can typically generate an economic return in a much lower potash price environment. And as a result of its location, we also think it has the potential to deliver fairly high margins because this is a bulk commodity, and in bulk commodities, transport and logistics makes up a huge proportion of your delivered cost to your customer. And our location really reduces that transport and logistics cost to any number of customers. There are multiple markets that we can service, not least of which is the country of Morocco, which is a large consumer of potash.
Mm, absolutely. Cool. Oh, okay. Well, Hayden, if someone's listening to this and likes the sound of this project and your company here, but are not following the story as yet, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, Chemisette is a development stage potash asset that we very strongly believe has the potential to be a low capital cost development in potash, which is very, very rare indeed. We're fully funded for the work program to assess the technical and economic viability of this project, and in the next 6 months, certainly, we're going to start delivering some really punchy news flow that allows people to make their own assessment of the technical and economic viability of this project.
Marvellous stuff. Hayden, good to chat to you. And like you say, you've got a busy couple of months coming up, so no doubt we'll be chatting again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Graham Lumsden, Chief Executive Officer of Motif Bio. MTFB is the ticker there. Graham, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome, Justin. Good to talk.
Yeah, it's been a while, and you've been busy going on there, so it's nice to catch up and see what's happening. And you've announced an RNS today, some significant news, and we'll get into that in a bit. Before we do, Graham, for people listening, so they're new to the podcast or they're not familiar with the company, can you summarise what is Motif Bio all about, please?
Sure. Motif Bio is a pharmaceutical biotechnology company developing antibiotics for serious and life-threatening infections, particularly in the hospital setting. And our lead program is a new antibiotic called Iclaprim. We have a new drug application already submitted to the U.S. FDA, Food and Drug Administration, with an expectation of a decision in a February timeframe. So we're all about antibiotics and trying to overcome the problem with patients running out of options because of resistance to these superbugs that we see in hospitals these days. Iclaprim is our lead asset, a novel antibiotic, very well differentiated versus currently available and antibiotics in development.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, this news out. Motif Bio announces notice of allowance for two U.S. Iclaprim patents with expiration in 2037. That sounds very positive. Can you take me into the details of that, please, Graham?
Yes, absolutely. So these two patents give us additional market exclusivity in the United States through November of 2037. So we've previously talked about our market exclusivity being 10 years from the date of approval. So assuming that Iclaprim were to get approved in the first quarter of next year, 2019, the 10 years of market exclusivity that we are already entitled to would take us to 2029. These two patents extend that by a further 8 years where competitors are not able to bring copies of Iclaprim to the market in the United States. And the background behind these patents, we think, is pretty interesting. We met with the U.S. FDA, Food and Drug Administration, back in April of 2015, and basically had a dialogue with them about taking Iclaprim into phase three to study serious life-threatening infections in the hospital setting in order to be able to submit the new drug application. The FDA said, go ahead. Mm-hmm. And they said, we think that Motif Bio should use a fixed dose of Iclaprim in the phase three trials. Previously, Iclaprim had been used in patients using what's called a weight-based dose. That means you weigh each patient individually and you calculate a separate dose for each patient depend on weight. The FDA believed that that was not the best way to use Aquaprim. They were particularly concerned that low body weight patients, so small patients, would not receive enough Aquaprim if it was dosed on a weight basis. So they recommended that we move to a fixed dose. And that's what we did. In our phase three program, every patient received the same dose, 80 milligrams of Aquaprim twice daily, every 12 hours. And so what we were able to do, and the basis for these two patents, was we were able to select 80 milligrams as the optimized dose. And what was not obvious, which is the basis for a patent, was that it was not obvious that you could select a fixed dose that would optimize both safety and efficacy. And we were able to do this because of the wealth of scientific data that we have on Aquaprim. We were able to do what's called Monte Carlo simulation and modeling to identify 80 milligram as the optimal dose to maximize safety and efficacy. And because it wasn't obvious that you could do that, mm-hmm. I mean, normally you would optimize a dose for efficacy or safety. To do it for both was not obvious. And that was the basis for these patents. And it's taken us until now to get these patents, to get the notice of allowance from the patent office. So we're very pleased with this. We think it's a very important piece that adds to the potential value of our asset, Aquaprim.
Yeah, it's almost 20 years. That's a long, old time, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the length of patents are usually 20 years from the date of issue.
Okay, all right. Marvellous. So at the moment, like you said there, you did sort of touch on it, but where are you at the moment with Aquaprim and Graham, just to reiterate?
Yep, so we announced that we'd completed the submission of our NDA, new drug application, to the US FDA, and we anticipate being able to announce later this month that they've accepted our submission, and that at that time they should confirm what's called the PDUFA date. PDUFA stands for Prescription Drug User Fee Act, would you believe? Mm-hmm. Basically, it's because Aquaprim has been designated as a qualified infectious disease product, we get the benefit of a priority review once it's accepted. So instead of the usual 10-month review period, we get a priority review of 6 months. So we would expect when we announce the acceptance by the FDA, we should have a confirmed date 6 months from now, so February, as the decision date from the FDA for approval to market.
Excellent stuff. Wow, that's exciting. One final thing to do, Graham. If someone's listening to this right now, likes the sound of what you're doing, the progress you're making, but are not following the story as yet, give them three quick reasons, if you could, why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Absolutely. Number one, I think most people are familiar with the coverage that we read almost on a daily basis about superbugs, including things like MRSA, where patients are dying in hospital because the antibiotics currently available are no longer effective against these superbugs that have mutated and developed resistance. So we have a novel antibiotic called Aquaprim that works in a very different way and is particularly well suited to serious and life-threatening infections in patients in a hospital. Secondly, this is a very late stage opportunity to participate in a pharmaceutical biotech investment. As I just explained, we're expecting a decision from the FDA on approval to market, most likely in the first quarter of next year. And third, the announcement today of the notice of allowance for two U.S. patents gives us potential for additional commercial opportunity out through November 2037. So I think those are the three key reasons that it would be of interest to investors to take a look at us.
Excellent stuff. Graham, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russell Lamming, Chief Executive Officer of Keras Resources. KRS is ticker there. Russell, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks very much for having me, Justin.
We got a whole bunch of questions from private investors. I know you're looking forward to. But before we get into those, Russell, for someone who just tuned in and maybe not familiar with the company, summarise Keras Resources, if you could, in a minute or less.
Of course. Thank you, Justin. Kiris is an AIM-listed company with a market cap of around £8 million and projects in Australia and Togo, West Africa. In Australia, we currently have a 36% interest in the Calidus Resources Company, which is ASX-listed, developing the Warrawoona Gold Project in the Pilbara, with currently just north of 700,000 ounces in resource. In Togo, we have an 85% interest in the 14 million ton Nyega manganese project and are currently in the final mine permitting stages there. We've just recently been given approval to do a bulk sample on in Togo, so very excited about that.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, these questions are sort of bunched together into different sections of the business, so I'll put them all together, hopefully remember them and answer them.
Yeah, sure.
But so these are our Togo questions related. So first of all, what is the current status of Nyega Manganese Project? Also, it says, I'd be grateful if Russell could provide more information on the Togo bulk sampling deal. Also grateful if you could provide an update on progress towards getting a full production license, and are there any more steps required to acquire a mining license for Nyega? So hopefully you can remember that, Russell.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, let's start with the regulatory information. We are still operating within the framework of our four exploration permits, and the bulk sample program that I mentioned earlier falls under the authority of those licenses. There's nothing outstanding from Kiris' side with regards the exploitation permit application. And other than maintaining a regular dialogue with the authorities in Togo, we have no additional steps to complete for the permit to be awarded. I think it's important to note that what is essentially a trial mining exercise is a significant step forward in this process. But unfortunately, we are not able to give any further guidance on when that exploitation permit will be granted. With regards to the bulk sample, the third-party manganese alloy producer is funding the project, and we've already received funds to cover long lead capital items and all management costs. We've not entered into any offtake agreement, and now the parties are obligated to pursue this further. However, I think it's worth noting that the positives surrounding this bulk sample and the fact that a potential off-taker is willing to spend a significant amount on the bulk sample, it's an endorsement to both the project, the quality of the project, and steps management have taken to mitigate the project risk. And then with regard newsflow in Togo, the directors understand comments with regards information there, but we are restricted in what we can announce, as this is an area of sensitivity for both the Togolese authorities and the bulk sample funders. I think that sort of covers all the questions, does it, Justin?
Yeah, marvellous. Let's move on to the Kamina project. I hope I pronounced that correctly. It says, what is the current status of Kamina cobalt and nickel project, please?
Sure. I think the short answer is the project is effectively on hold until we are granted the exploitation permit at Nyega. And although we are solely focused on the Nyega project, we are meeting all our obligations with respect to the Kamina project.
Okay, good. Moving on to the Calidus questions. There are three here. So what proportion of Calidus shares will be distributed to Kiris shareholders? Will you be giving new and existing shareholders sufficient early notice so that people don't miss out on the offer? And also, my broker does not deal in ASX shares, and my Kiris shares are held in a tax-protected SIP and ISA accounts. There we are. Deal with that one.
All right. Calidus, with regards to Calidus, as you know, we've got 450 million shares in Calidus at the moment and another 265 million performance shares that are outstanding. These will vest on a successful completion of a pre-feas, which is hopefully out in early 2019. As part of the ASX listing rules, all our shares are held in escrow until the 23rd of June 2019. We have no control over this and are not able to do anything with these shares until they are out of escrow. However, as mentioned in previous RNSs, we've commenced planning for the most efficient way to distribute these shares, as well as proposals on how our shareholders can efficiently hold and deal the ASX shares. We've undertaken to distribute these shares to shareholders pro rata their interest in Kiris free of charge. So no such offer will be made as asked in that earlier question. If you are a shareholder at the time when these shares are distributed, you will receive your pro rata of what are distributed. The actual amount distributed will be a function of the company's capital needs at the time. And the actual method for distribution, although still in discussions, it looks like the most practical and efficient route will be by a company reconstruction. With regards trading an ASX-listed entity, there are many UK brokers who do trade and deal in ASX shares. However, the directors expect to arrange introductions to an Australian-based broker if required.
Okay. The next bit, there are a few questions relating to directors' remuneration and the share appreciation rights scheme and what management have actually delivered to deserve this remuneration. Could you comment on that side of it, please, Russell?
Yes, sure. This is always an interesting bunch of questions, and I think a lot of people in our situation deal with them. I think let's start with what the directors have delivered. You know, as the name suggests, Ferrex, which was the previous name of Ceres, was listed as an iron ore company. The collapse of the iron ore price at the end of 2014 was unforeseen and was responsible for the collapse of several iron ore companies at that time. At this juncture, the directors undertook a strategic review and decided to divest its iron ore assets and move into Australian gold projects. The initial Australian royalty projects, which we moved into, were a step along the way to what has essentially moved into the flotation of Calidus. While they may not have been very successful, the decision to move into gold in Australia has been very, very successful. Initially, the company raised $1.25 million at the start of the strategy. So from a return on investment, I think Ceres' current see-through value in Calidus of £15 million speaks for itself. From a remuneration perspective, the current directors are all significant shareholders in the business, and the combined shareholding of with a combined shareholding of approximately 23%. To date, the current directors have invested more money in the business than they've taken out. We've participated in fundraising since IPO and pre-IPO, and have frequently made loans into the company. In addition, as seen in early June, the directors have supported the share price by buying in the market. With regards to a share appreciation scheme, I don't think there's a holy grail when it comes to incentive schemes, but it's pretty standard for companies to have these incentive schemes. The Ceres scheme is less dilutive than issuing standard option and was subject to approval by shareholders. That vote was overwhelmingly in favour of the scheme. However, I think it's important to note that the SARs themselves have no current value to the holders. The holders will only benefit if they build value in the company, which is exactly what an incentive scheme should focus on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Next, the last section here is about sort of future opportunities. It's three of these. Do you want me to bunch these together or do it individual?
Carry on. Just bunch them together now.
Okay. What type of new opportunities are the company looking for in terms of metals, stage of exploration, jurisdiction and scale? Are there actual plans for fundraising and dilution given the possible allocation of 600 million new shares? And what actions are under consideration to close the value disconnect between Ceres market cap and Calidus holding market value?
Okay, as an exploration development company, we are always looking for new opportunities. Our focus is not on any specific commodity or jurisdiction, but identifying near-term low capex cash generative projects. With regards to future capital raises, there are no current plans. The management fees from the bulk sample should cover our current requirements. That said, if we do identify a new opportunity which requires more capital, we would consider raising capital at that time. With regards to value disconnect between asset value and market cap, while we take every opportunity to draw attention to the disconnect in our announcements and on the website, it's important to focus on our current assets and continue to add value to them. This is happening both in Australia and the Pilbara and in Togo. It's not unusual for a company with a diversified portfolio to have a market cap below the combined value of its underlying assets. That said, as we near the end of the escrow period and the publication of the proposed PFS, I expect that gap will narrow.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Russell, One final thing to do, as always, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Sure. We've got an exciting portfolio of assets with near-term cash flow in Togo combined with the long-term upside in the Pilbara. We have a management team that has a robust track record of identifying quality projects and proving them up and realizing value for shareholders. And thirdly, as a board, we now own approximately 23% of the issued share capital, something that I hope telegraphs our levels of confidence in Keras.
Good stuff. Russell, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Aidan Bishop, founder and chairman of Big Dish. That's D-I-S-H. Dish is the ticker there. Aidan, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
So you've released some positive news about your UK growth strategy, and we'll go into that in a bit. Before we do, Aidan, of course, you've just listed, so not many people would have heard of you. Can you explain what Big Dish is all about, please?
Yeah, Big Dish is very simple. We are a yield management platform for restaurants. So we allow restaurants to optimize their revenue by bringing in more customers, particularly at off-peak times, by offering smart discounts.
Yeah, I like that. So I like this. So you called it a yield. What was the terminology for that?
Well, it's called yield management. So yield management is basically a dynamic pricing strategy. It charges a different price at a different time for the same product. I mean, the airline industry started this in the 1970s, and it totally changed the way airline seats are sold. The hotel industry, the same. So we are now in the restaurant sector, bringing yield management to the restaurant sector, which traditionally is a lower or a slower adopter of technology. So the opportunity for disruption in this space is absolutely enormous. And what we're looking to disrupt is the old-fashioned dining discount card model. So nobody wants to, you know, flash cards around or try to find out when seats are available, or, you know, print out coupons and vouchers and so forth. With Big Dish, you can make a reservation instantly confirmed within three taps. And we operate currently in three different Asian cities, and we just announced yesterday our UK growth strategy.
Yeah, exactly. No, I love this idea. Of course, it makes sense. Like I said, because you have got that those times when restaurants just get jam packed. Everyone wants to go at the same time. And if you offered,
absolutely. I used to have a restaurant as I was a silent partner in a restaurant, and I used to go there and I used to notice that, like, sometimes prolonged periods where there's very few customers, but you've still got to pay the rent. You've still got the you know, the power. You've still got staff. So yield management works when there are fixed overheads, and it allows you to optimize your revenue and contribute towards those overheads by bringing additional revenue. So it's great.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, if you look at the, you know, restaurant, like you said, and you're always jam-packed from 7 till sort of 10, and then it's empty, or half full during lunch, then obviously you can do things about that, can't you? So let's go into this. So you say you're in the Far East at the moment, and now you've announced the UK growth strategy. So what does this entail?
So the UK growth strategy, firstly, we announced yesterday the completion of the acquisition of Table Pouncer. So Table Pouncer was one of the first yield management platforms in the world, and it started in Bournemouth. And I knew it was a winner from the moment I discovered how successful they were in Bournemouth. So you've got Bournemouth of a population of less than 200,000 people. Table Pouncer was seating through their platform over 120,000 people per year in Bournemouth. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw that, I knew we had a winner here. And so I thought we had to acquire that company, and we've done that. And we've announced how we're coming into the UK. So what we're going to do in September, we are doing a better launch or a soft launch in Bath. You'll see Bath is our chosen city to start Big Dish in the UK. And following that, we will very rapidly migrate all the Big Dish, all the Bournemouth restaurants and users onto the Big Dish platform. And then following that, we will follow out a wider rollout strategy that will focus on, you know, the provincial cities and towns.
And I've got to say, UK, you know, as far as restaurants are concerned, it's very good and it's getting better by all accounts, isn't it? Because you've got, I mean, and you can just see that in what's on TV these days. There's all these, you know, aspirational sort of shows become better cooks, better chefs. And I used to live with a friend in London, and he used to have a second home in Bournemouth. He said, come to Bournemouth one weekend, we go for something to eat. And we had a cracking restaurant down there, and I was really impressed with it. So, it's going well. So, and how long will this take, this sort of rollout then?
Well, I mean, we're going to start starting next month in Bath, and so we do a soft launch there, and the following month we will kick off in Bournemouth, and that will involve migrating all of the Table Pouncer users and restaurants to the Big Dish app. We've been preparing for this for about 6 months, and then following that we will plot our wider opportunity. I mean, to give you an idea, I mean, if you look at the traditional old-fashioned outdated restaurant discount cards like Taste Card, acquired for £100 million, by the way, they've got like 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 restaurants across the UK. So our value proposition to restaurants is a lot clearer and a lot more friendly, in that we allow restaurants complete flexibility over the hours they choose, the number of seats, the size of the discount, and it's just a much more convenient solution for restaurants. So we see that the UK could be a very, very large market for us.
Yeah, and so just an example, so it works by what, they sign up to you and then they pay whenever as a booking happens, what happens?
That's right. So the restaurants pay a fee per head. So every diner seated via Big Dish, the restaurants pay us a small fee per person. And of course, we give the restaurants an app as well. And if someone doesn't show up, for example, then they can flag that as a no-show. I mean, no-shows are always a problem for restaurants, even if somebody makes a reservation by telephone and so forth. OpenTable, the world's biggest reservation platform, has a no-show rate of about 5%. And Big Dish is just a little bit under that at the moment. So all very, very positive signs.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, well, Aidan, one final thing to do. If someone's listening right now and likes the sound of this, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, Big Dish is a food tech company, and food tech is a really hot space within the consumer tech world at the moment. And it's just a great story and very easily to understand for investors as well. I think secondly, that what we're doing is disruptive. So when people are following us or investing in us, they're investing into a company that is seeking to disrupt the restaurant industry. So it's an exciting journey ahead for us. And if people like it, follow us and join us and experience it with us.
Exactly, good stuff. And good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Okay, it's time for the top five most popular RNSs of the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At five, Motif Bio, MTFB, investor events in August and September. Of course, I spoke to Graham earlier. At four, Ascent Resources, notice of shareholder call conference. At three, also Ascent Resources, permitting update. At two, Angus Energy. SCC approves planning application for Brockham late yesterday afternoon. And number one, most popular RNS came from EVRH, or EVR Holdings, Melody VR, and NEC Group exclusive partnership. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.